It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
Happy Thanksgiving. We can't sing the real Happy Thanksgiving song because it's copyrighted.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. We can't afford to pay royalties on this.
They sent us a letter. Actually, they didn't send us a letter. It was, you know, knock, knock, knock. You've been served. That kind of deal. Luckily, we weren't recording when that happened.
Is there anybody? What do you call those people?
Well, sometimes it's like the sheriff. But,
like, there's people who, like, that's sort of their profession.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh. I thought, like, you know, maybe it was a lawyer had someone who, like, who worked for them that they would have go do it.
I think that's a job.
A lot of times it's like a law enforcement officer sometimes.
Yeah, but I think there's like a job of people for do it for like civil cases and stuff. And what I want to see is one of them, sort of like the singing telegram thing, I want one of them to do it, but they dress in a tracksuit with a lot of chains and carry a boombox and like break dance and then say, you got served. why are those not together? Why have those not?
I don't know.
Matched up. Anyway, hello, welcome to the Magical Talking Hat podcast, the only podcast that is specifically done so that the two hosts talk to each other, thereby ensuring none of you have to talk to us. So you're welcome. We both made that sacrifice.
Yep.
I'm Tony.
And I'm William. This is episode 194, our fourth annual Thanksgiving episode.
And wherever you are, it's Thanksgiving, unless you're listening to this late, in which case, catch up, bastards.
You see, we always have, I mean, our deal is we always post a podcast on Thursday. Which means every year we're going to have a Thanksgiving
William
podcast.
Is fascinated by this.
However,
I'm fascinated by this for years.
This season, we're also going to have a Christmas podcast and a New Year's podcast. And then right after that, episode 200. Three big ones in a row.
William is going to be really annoyingly excited for the next, like, month.
Yep.
For those of you just joining us, happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Lay on the couch, unbutton your pants, relax. I'll explain to you how this works. We have a hat. It's magical. Has its own email address. TheMagicalTalkingHat@gmail.com. People like yourselves, when they're done with their nap, write into the email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com, with little things, questions, comments, topics for us. And the hat, on its own, magically transmogrifies those emails into little note cards with the information written on them. We, its sometime servants, draw those out at random from the hat, read them on the air, talk about them until we're bored, do that for like an hour, and that's the show.
And hopefully you are listening. Hopefully you are listening on Thanksgiving, because as all of our listeners will tell you, our podcast is the tryptophan of podcasts.
Yes. And mostly I just like the idea of a family getting together around the table, say a little prayer, and then everybody listen to the podcast.
Yeah.
Little Timmy prefers the drumstick of the podcast.
It makes you feel good and tired when you're done.
And Grandma likes to chew on the gizzard. That sounds way dirtier.
And there's always plenty of gravy.
Yep, all gravy. This is going to be my first, and possibly only, but who knows, my first Weight Watchers Thanksgiving.
Yes, it is.
Coupled with a visit to Oregon to my family this year.
Yeah.
We normally don't go at holidays anymore because it's just that much extra layer of crazy that sort of makes the trip more complicated for no good reason. But this year, Thanksgiving is very late And my father's birthday is December 1st, which in this case is the Monday right after Thanksgiving.
That's right.
And he turns 80.
Wow.
So I'm going, my brother's going, everybody's going. It'll be the first time since our wedding, mine and Trisha's, not mine and William's, that all the children have been together at the same place.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that's over 10 years ago.
Yep. So, but yeah, so the whole experience, going to Oregon, I eat lots of stuff there because of lots of seafood and things like that. And then Thanksgiving, it's going to be Thanksgiving. And so I'm confident I can do it, but I'm really going to have to pay attention to all the stuff to stay on my points. But I've been doing well. I'm down to 22 pounds down since I started.
Yep.
I'm at 370 even. Haven't been that in, I have no idea how long, really long time.
Well, good job. Congratulations.
I've been kind of sick, as you can hear. I don't know if you could hear it last week so much, but been a little bit snotty. I had a head cold, pretty much had me out this whole weekend.
Oh.
It kind of went into my chest for a little while, but it's mostly staying up in my sinuses. It's kind of annoying. But what are you going to do? So... How you doing?
I'm fine. I'm good. Good.
How was your 10 minutes?
It was fine.
Did you see any movies during that 10 minutes?
No. There are some things I didn't talk about last time that I could, unless you have something...
Are they also Batman?
No. They're not really interesting. They're just things I could talk about.
The stuff you talked about before wasn't
really interesting. I know. I realize nothing I talk about is interesting, but... Do you feel like we should fill up some time, or can we go right to that?
I don't care. We can go to the house.
Did you have anything else that you didn't talk about last time?
I don't think so. I covered being sick. I covered the trip. As of the time of listening this, I will have spent a weekend being a bachelor vegetable again. Not entirely. The producer is going on a retreat. But not going on. It's like a half hour from here, so she'll still be coming home to like sleep.
Oh, okay.
But like it starts Friday evening, and so she'll leave Friday evening, and then she'll come back and probably just go to bed, and I'll stay up late, and then by the time I wake up, she'll be gone Saturday, and you know, so a lot of the time
I'm going to a wedding before people hear this again.
Oh,
I haven't been to a wedding for a long time, and it's back in Des Moines. Saturday.
Is it a family one or a friend one?
A friend of the family.
Oh, okay.
I mean, you know, a friend of my sister's, really.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, we know their family. And,
yeah.
And my friend from New York, who I've sometimes talked about, and she's in the radio play and stuff, she's going to be there. So it'll be nice to see her, because I don't think I've seen her in over 25 years.
Wow.
So that'll be nice.
So really... She could look completely different, and so they could just send in a substitute, and you wouldn't know it was her.
No, I know. I mean, I've talked to her. I just haven't, like, seen her, like, in person. And,
Yeah, but still, she could look totally different.
Well, like, we've Skyped before, and you know.
That's...
She was in
could have already gotten
and
the person.
And we did the Google,
I've heard
Hangout.
Her voice, too, but that's easy to fake.
Nope. But it was video and audio of all those people. I mean, you saw her, too, probably.
I don't think so, no.
Well, maybe.
But again, you could just loop in something else.
Whatever, anyway.
The point is, you've been living in essentially a Truman Show thing your entire life.
I hope she can make it because, you know, over there's been some pretty harsh weather.
When the ratings started to drop, it was when they introduced me. That did not go well for them.
But anyway, that's what's going to be going on with me this coming weekend. I mean, as long as we can make it too, I don't know. Maybe the weather won't cooperate. I have no idea.
Here's the thing. It's going to be above freezing in the daytime, which is good. But it's going to rain, which is not a big deal.
Yeah.
But then at night, it gets below freezing, and so that all fucking freezes.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm a little worried about Trisha because of that. But Trisha's pretty good at driving in crazy weather.
I'm a very cautious driver. I mean, if I think that it's going to be icy on the way back, I won't even go.
You are.
A lot of people...
You've been very cautious just coming over here, which is like 10 miles or whatever.
Yeah, I'm a pretty cautious driver.
Which I don't think is a bad thing to be. Are we done yet?
Well, the thing I didn't talk about last week, maybe I'll just talk about it briefly, is, you know, I never seem to follow your advice about not talking to people online, because I still have faith
Oh, that kind of thing.
Online communities can be a place where people can get together and they can share ideas and they can grow.
No. Although I had to learn, I learned the final lesson on Second Life forums. And then after that, I've never gone back.
The thing is, from the very beginning, I mean, when I was using bulletin boards in like 1988, it was like this. It's always been like this.
The only thing that's changed is we've become more aware that it's like this. Back then it was a new thing, and who would have necessarily predicted that it would be like this? But now we know, and that's I can tell you, actually, don't do it.
Actually, I wrote a paper where I predicted it could be like this, but I thought it could also be something else, and probably some combination of the two. I was hoping it wouldn't be just like this.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people actually predicted, yeah, this could be just how it is. And, you know, they made a big deal out of anonymity, and they still do. Oh, it's anonymity. No, it's not just anonymity. It's a lot of things. But all these things combined, it's pretty bad. It's pretty hard to find a forum where you can find even one person who's reasonable to talk to.
Yeah.
And this time, I tried to talk to other anarchists, which I've never really done before. I'll just read anarchist stuff, you know. But this time I thought, you know what, I'm going to talk to some. Oh, that was a bad idea. Bad idea. Because, you know, I've actually, you know, when I meet people the first time, it doesn't come up that I'm an anarchist right away. They find this out a little bit later. And then when I tell them, a lot of times I get a response that's something like, you can't be an anarchist because you seem like a nice guy. And I didn't really know what that meant. Like, so you've known a lot of other anarchists and they were jerks? Yeah, pretty much.
Well, most people's view of anarchy is tied into movies. And Hollywood's version of anarchy, and anarchy used specifically as a negative connotation.
Well, there is that, but even outside of that, even when it's not about like a popular popular notions of that, like when these people have known people who call themselves anarchists, and they were jerks.
I believe that.
Self-righteous, arrogant, elitist, ironically enough. How could an anarchist be an elitist? I don't know, but they are.
Because it'd be
exclusive.
You're intellectually elitist.
Right, but to the point where if you don't agree with what they believe, they think you haven't educated yourself enough about it, and you have no right even to engage in a discussion about it. So that is exact opposite of anarchist, really. Yeah. But it just, and some people... there's also some people I've talked to who said, yeah, but, you know, they talk to me and they understand that, well, like, I'll still say I'm an anarchist. They, yeah, but you've said that you vote and that you write letters to Congress. Well, that you can be an anarchist and do those things, but the anarchists they know would say, no, you can't do any of those things because you are affirming and supporting the system when you do that, which I think is absurd. I mean, that...
Because it's... You espouse anarchism as a belief in a particular social and economic model.
The anarchism
that is frequently espoused by the people you're talking about is not belief in a model. It is violent rejection of another model.
Well, that's
and not even... It's wholly deconstructionist and wholly, in my opinion, reactive. You do things not because they go towards your anarchist ideal, but because they oppose whatever this other aspect of government or society
is part
that
of
you
it.
Hate.
But I mean, I had a discussion with someone about this online about, well, if you vote, you're giving strength or power to the system. And I said, okay, so what you're telling me is, right now, voter turnout's not very good. Like 30% is good for a lot of people. So what you're telling
in this
me,
country.
What you're telling me is if 50% of the if it goes from 30% to 50%, that's going to make the government more powerful. Or if it goes from 30% to 20%, the government's less powerful. Yeah. I mean that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Voting doesn't make the government more powerful. Yeah. So there's no harm in doing it, right? The reason that a lot of
and in theory. You can affect change.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Well, and I brought up net neutrality. Net neutrality is something that would benefit about any anarchist. So
the
why
amount
not,
of misconceptions about net neutrality.
Why not go ahead and vote for a candidate who you think will stand up for it or write a letter to the FCC about it? Why not do that? Okay, so what I'm noticing, though, is that what it's really about for anarchists who don't want to do it is they think the people who do it are chumps. and they feel superior to them. So yeah. That's why they're never going to do it. Yeah. It's not really because of any ideological or philosophical reason or even a practical reason. They're just being arrogant jerks.
Yes.
And it's like, and wow, how can a person who says they're an anarchist be like this?
Because their version of anarchism is I get to do whatever I want. And what's funny, I'm going to draw a really weird parallel that may make you slightly uncomfortable, but I need you to prepare for this.
Okay.
Within the BDSM community, I noticed, not common because they frequently get weeded out pretty quick, there is a variety of dominant that is usually male, but not always, that you quickly learn they are involved in the BDSM community and they are identified as dominant because they like to always have their way. And in their mind, though they might not articulate it as such, that's what it means to be in the dominant role, is you just get things your way. And in reality, in a BDSM situation, being in the dominant role, you have authority, you also have far and away the most responsibility, and you have a lot of duty to submissives in those situations.
Well, that's right, but also that doesn't strike me in the context you're talking about, where, like you say, they want to have their way. That seems like it's not really a kink anymore.
No.
That's
just a life preference, yeah, essentially. Yeah, and, yeah. And that's the same thing. It becomes, and that's what the anarchists are like. I don't like living in the situation I have, so I'm going to be an anarchist in that I wish everybody would just let me do whatever I want.
Well, the ironic thing is, while they think they're really knowledgeable and smart, and they do know a lot of facts, like they can quote a lot of historical facts to you, they have no clue what it is they're talking about.
Yeah.
They're remarkably ignorant for people who know so much about factual, you know, historical facts. But they have no idea how to have a discussion or an argument, even though they think they do. It's basically...
Their model is relatively static. And here's the funny thing. I think in most cases, their model is relatively static, and it is also relatively small scale. Because you say, okay, give me your anarchy, your anarchic society. It's them and a few like-minded people living in the wilderness alone.
Well, I don't know. I mean, these particular people I was talking to, they seem to think that... It seemed like their model, and I'm probably oversimplifying it to be fair, but their model seemed to be you get rid of government, you just let business do everything, and everything will work out fine. Even if it ends up with huge corporations, you know, because if a corporation gets big in the free market, well, that's fair. I mean, without any understanding that you don't get corporations without governments backing them. That wouldn't even happen. Or any notion of how it's not a free market if it's not a fair market, you know. Yeah. And when you try to explain all that stuff, they immediately peg you as, well, you must be a communist anarchist, and that means you're stupid. And so we're not even going to read what you're saying. We're not even going to respond to what your points. And they just, you know, they just start acting like children, basically.
Yeah.
While it's clear they think they're being all smart and whatever. And they really kind of start to troll you, really, is what happens. And then you realize, okay, obviously we're not having a real conversation here, and you quit.
Yeah.
But it's... It's so discouraging because, you know, it's just discouraging.
Our anarchists more along your lines exist. They don't do a lot of talking on the internet. And here's another thing. This is another similar parallel. I've talked to many understanding, even-handed, intelligent, ingratiating, friendly atheists. None of them have been... atheists on the internet.
Okay, and this is why I brought this up, because I want to ask you a question.
Yes.
Because this is how it's starting to look, and you can tell me if this is how it is or not, because you probably know. I don't know. But it seems like there's two kinds of people. People who are just like you said, reasonable, you know, they can have a good conversation with you, whatever, who would never try to have a conversation on the internet for whatever reason. They don't use it. It just doesn't occur to them, or they already have a preconceived notion about how crappy it is. Whatever the reason is, they just would never do it. And then there are the people who are inclined to have a conversation on the internet who also happen to be jerks. And there's but you really can't find people in between. Like it's like no person who is decent to talk to is going to try to have a conversation on the end. Only idiots are going to try to have a conversation.
For the sake of this conversation, I'm going to say yes. The reality is there is a gray area, and it's just the two extremes tend to be the more obvious ones. But yes, this is a thing. And it becomes self-propagating because the jerks that are on the internet scare off the reasonable people who might be on the internet, and so then they don't get on the internet. So again, those people aren't. And I think there's reasons behind this. I think there's reasons in both directions. One is, I think, I have no backing for this. I'm not citing anything. I believe, based on my own personal damn experience, that there is a tendency for those people who are particularly vocal and active in communication on the internet, specifically, to be doing that because, for whatever reason, they don't have an audience in their real life. Hmm. And so they don't have people. Maybe they don't have people who want to listen to what they have to say. Or maybe they just don't have people.
Well,
but for whatever reason, they don't have a real life output for it. So they put it on there. So there's a certain level of insecurity already, and a certain level of almost valve release that, like,
yeah.
I wanted to talk about this and nobody will, so I can do it on the internet, so pow!
Well, certainly, if you were a psychologist talking to these people and seeing how they're behaving for no apparent reason, right? I mean, you know, unprovoked attacks and everything. From a psychologist perspective, you'd think, this person's got some issues. I mean, you know, someone's bullied them around and made them feel small, and this is how they can feel big.
Yes.
And I mean, that's the obvious interpretation.
And then to my second point, which is not about the people and is actually about the
medium.
Yes, thank you. If you're going to have a conversation outside the internet about really anything, but let's say anarchy.
Okay.
Odds are good you are not going to walk into a room full of strangers and have a conversation with them. You might join like a club or something, and it might happen. But even then, it sort of gets approached in steps. And more likely, you're going to have a conversation about anarchy with me, or even about acquaintances, or like at Gaia's Feast, where you still know people, and most people in the room are sort of friends with at least some people in the room. Like, almost nobody's just like alone in there. Mm-hmm. And so, by definition, that kind of conversation is going to be more reasonable. Whereas if you just walk into a room, here's the equivalent. You walk into a room of strangers, but on top of that, they don't even see your face. The tendency to lose any sense of decorum, any sense of courtesy, but also any sense of humanity in the person you're talking to goes away very quickly.
Well, yes, but that happens, but it's not really as a rule, because you know you're human and you know how you expect people to treat you. And so when people talk about that a lot, about, well, you don't see the person's face, so it's easy to not treat them as a human being. Yes, that's true, but it doesn't have to be like that. I mean, you know, you have, basically, for you to forget this person's human, you kind of have to forget you are too, which that probably more contributes to your willingness to be a jerk than the fact that you don't see this person as
human.
But
it's another one of those tendencies of, like we're all aware it's going on. It doesn't mean that we don't do it subconsciously or just because we're weak. I mean, it's the same way of me saying, I know it's bad to smoke this cigarette, but I do, or I know it's bad to eat this cheeseburger or whatever, or I know it's bad to be mean to people, and yet sometimes I'm mean to people for no good reason. It's just a tendency that happens, and I mean, I do think a certain amount of self-awareness and a certain amount of growth negates these issues, and people who have achieved those, even when they're on the internet, aren't assholes.
Right, but it's not just that. I mean, the thing is, if you're not the kind of person who walks around wishing you could be meaner than you are.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like if I'm interacting with someone and I'm being a lot nicer than I really want to be.
But let's even back it up. Let's just say more assertive than you are. Because in some cases, they don't even see it as me.
No, okay, I get it, but...
They're just like, I want to really tell you what I think, but I can't, I don't have the guts, or I don't have this opportunity.
The reason I'm making this distinction is because too often I hear people talk about anonymity like it has this power that it does to people that they can't help. But I think it really only works that way for people who already don't feel like they're, like you said, they already don't feel like they're asserting themselves as much as they'd like to. So when they have when it unconsciously presents itself, all of the assertive options they have here that they don't have in real life, it just happens without them even reflecting on it.
I would agree. And there's a lot. This kind of behavior is frequently not accompanied by a lot of self-confidence or a lot of introspection.
Yeah, and or a lot of making sense.
Which is just
actually.
True in life, though.
It's just ridiculous.
Before the internet. That jackass that you would run into somewhere who would have the stupid... I mean, because the people you're talking about exist off the internet, too. They're just way less common. They're not... You go to a party and it's not everyone in the room, like on an internet chat room.
But no, but...
People like that still exist in the world, and
they always have. And what they used to do was treat their waitstaff bad.
Yes.
You know,
and those people already didn't have a whole lot of introspection and frequently had some insecurity issues.
Yeah, right.
But the problem with all this is we talk about this and we might already be talking about the past because all of this is dynamic. And what this means is the two big ones that come to mind is, like you said, everybody knows if you're a reasonable person, don't go talking on the internet,
yeah.
Which means that's going to happen less and less. And we're building a culture where kids from almost day one can go online and shit on whoever they want. What that's going to mean is it's going to be real easy for them to walk outside and shit on people in their real life. And you, because people always say, oh, if you were face to face with that person, you wouldn't say that. And in some cases, that's true. But in some cases, it's not. And the cases where it's not are getting more and more because as kids, that's a cultural norm for them.
I
can crap on this idea for this guy for having different ideas than me. And I know they're a person. Of course I do. I'm not stupid. And so if I see them in the real world, I'll do the same thing.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's a conscious effort. But that's going to propagate more and more. Mm. And then I don't know what happened. Then the reasonable people make a separate reasonable internet. I don't even know. Well, which can happen with hardcore moderation, certain forums and certain forum communities can be functional. They frequently need some very strong policies, some very strong enforcement, and I'm sure you will be shocked to know this, they tend to only operate within a certain scale size.
Yeah, right.
And when you get outside of that scale size, it becomes problematic.
Yep, that's exactly right. Well, another thing that surprised me was, there are some libertarians who are actually really close to being anarchists.
Okay. And libertarians are the third category I was thinking of when I was thinking anarchists, atheists, and libertarians.
Yeah. There are some libertarians that are really close to being anarchists.
Yes.
And to the point where a lot of anarchists read libertarian stuff and
agree with it.
And I saw one site that a lot of anarchists like that's actually a libertarian site where this person actually posted this thing to explain to libertarians why they should be feminist, why being feminist is actually a libertarian thing.
Okay.
And what bothered me and surprised me about that was, why do we have to have an article?
Well,
and what I realized was, what I remembered actually was, a lot of the anarchist stuff I'd seen on YouTube was, whenever it came up, and I saw it when I was looking at other things, was anarchists and or atheists criticizing feminism as a bogus thing, or criticizing, you know, the riots in Ferguson as, you know, all of the claims that African Americans are making that they're targeted unfairly by the police is false and bogus. It's not true, you know. And then, again, I wonder, how can an anarchist? I don't see how an anarchist could not be feminist or could not recognize that blacks are overrepresented in among the poor, overrepresented in prisons, and there's no other reason to explain this unless you think there's something wrong with African-American people, which I guess a lot of them think, you know.
Well, and don't forget the fact that I think if you look at most people who self-identify as anarchists, demographically speaking, so much male, so much white.
And a lot of white supremacists in the movement, too, actually.
And again, because it's a fundamental position that a lot of people take as an excuse to basically say, I want to be able to do whatever I want.
Yeah.
And in some ways, it's that same backlash against critical race theory and feminism. And it's white guys saying, now I'm oppressed and this is how I get out of
it. No,
that.
I think you're right. And I think the real critical thing there is you're saying anarchy isn't about we can do what we want. They are thinking,
I.
Jazz has made that point in conversations to me, too.
And
I think she's right.
This is another sad dose of real juice I got to drop on you here. Pretty much for any group of individuals out there that is not already specifically considered a strong feminist group, like by themselves and everything, for every other group out there, somebody probably needs to write a compelling essay explaining to them why they should be feminist. Because it's all over the place.
Yeah, that's true.
There are so many people in so many walks of life who still do that thing of, oh, I believe men and women should be equal, but I wouldn't go so far as, like, feminists are going.
Which is so weird. What feminists are you talking about?
Every day. And it's, honestly, it reminds me of being a freshman in college and being introduced to literary criticism.
Yeah.
Because I remember, and we all did it in that freshman English class, where we're like, well, I get that there's people put symbols and stuff, but you're really reading way too much into this. And that's what it is. People say, I believe men and women are equal, but you're really reading way too much into, oh, music videos, TV shows, fashion, come on.
Video games.
Yeah, no, like, it's not, you know, well, and everybody shies away from the phrase rape culture, which I've just recently been thinking about that.
Well, that's what this libertarian article was about. Yeah. And it was trying to get them to understand that rape culture isn't saying every man's a rapist. Rape culture is saying that the rapists put every man in a position of power.
Yeah.
Because, you know.
Well, and which, I've just recently been thinking about media, entertainment media, going back, films, TV shows, and stuff like that. And just the shit we were talking about earlier. Was it now or was it a week ago? Linda Carter's Wonder Woman, how we can have this empowering speeches and then we have this catfight.
Yeah.
And that's where rape culture lied, because at the time, nobody batted an eye about that. And people who were very strong on equal rights for women and everything, there were, I mean, obviously not everyone. I'm sure there were people being outraged. But people who were totally like, men and women can do the same things, didn't bat an eye at that. Thought that was normal. Yeah. And that it always has been. I mean, and that's why classic songs like Baby, It's Cold Outside is a fucking date rape song.
Yeah.
And nobody noticed for decades.
Right.
That kind of shit happens all the time.
Oh, right.
And it has been happening for decades. And that's the thing. That might be the end to sort of show rape culture to people, is to say, you know how we look back and say, holy shit, what were they? They had no idea. That's because it's that institutionalized.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And the fact that we look back at it now amused and not horrified says something.
There was a journalist who was interviewed on Fresh Air, and she was talking about sexting, the culture of sexting. And the main focus of it was about the law. Like, how should the law react to this? And in the course of this woman talking about the sexting culture among teens, she talked about how teenage boys really collect pictures of naked teenage girls like trading cards.
Yeah.
And she even said to an extent that it's not like they're even really titillated by them or anything.
No.
They're just cards and they share them or whatever. And she de-emphasized that as being relatively harmless, and what you really want to worry about is how and what should be illegal, or when the law should get involved, is when they post these pictures online without the girl's permission. And I remember hearing that and saying, and why should they think they need to ask permission from an object, right? If they took a picture of their dog, they wouldn't ask their dog permission to put it online. The problem isn't that they're posting these online. The problem is that these girls are trading cards.
Yes.
And what's more is, that's not new. For decades, you know, you're putting a notch on your sexual conquest, whatever, belt or bedpost or whatever, was something that high school boys were supposed to do. This is the same thing. It's just in a different medium.
Yes.
But here we are scratching our heads about it like it's this newfangled thing and the only problem with it is it's a new technology that we don't understand. No, this is the same thing that's always gone on.
Yeah.
And it's always going to go on. Until
unless there's a fundamental change.
Yeah,
in
until
culture.
We stop saying, oh, well, we just should make it illegal that they're posting us. I'm like, no, it's not about the law.
No.
It's about the culture.
That's something I've actually run into this at work a lot. As business models, because we've had a lot of reorganization and stuff, and there's a lot of stuff my company wants to do, and it's awesome stuff. It's stuff that involves fundamental changes in the business culture,
mm-hmm, right.
And they keep thinking, we're going to institute this policy to make it happen. And I'm like, that might be a step in the right direction,
yeah, might.
But that won't do it.
No.
And that will never do it. We can't set a rule that then changes the culture.
No, that's... doesn't work like that.
The culture.
Yeah.
You have to
right.
come at it from many directions. You have to come at it from a very holistic perspective. You have to understand that it's not a behavior you're changing, it's a mindset.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't want to stop the kids from doing that. You want to raise kids that don't want to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
And not even don't raise kids that are scared to do that.
No, no, no,
or
not scared,
like
but understand all of the implications.
Kids that don't want to do it.
Yeah, and realize, yeah, this is not a good thing to do, so I won't do it. That's right.
Or even just kids for whom it would never come up.
Well,
that
sure.
That also works. But yeah.
But I mean, if boys and girls were instead of taught what they are taught now, which is that girls are objects,
yeah.
And a girl has to spend 2 hours in the bathroom getting ready before she goes to high school.
Yeah.
And that's very common, by the way, because she's an object that has to decorate herself. And a boy, you know, I saw a video where this girl was saying, as soon as you say you'll be a guy's girlfriend or whatever, he's immediately asking for nude photos. Like,
yeah.
Boom. Like, it's
sometimes before that.
It's expected. He is going to ask for it. And if you're going to stay his girlfriend, you have to do it.
Which I've seen some hilarious responses to that request.
Okay, but still.
That
that's,
we're not nude photos. No, absolutely.
That's
no,
a
that's
cultural
a thing.
Phenomenon
yeah.
That's disturbing, yet based on the way things have been for a very
absolutely.
Long time and
absolutely.
Will not change unless boys
hell,
and girls are taught that girls are not objects.
World War II or whatever, and the guy has a picture of his girlfriend or whatever. It's always something sexy looking or whatever. It's them in a bathing suit or whatever.
Sure, sure.
The woman doesn't have him shirtless. Like, she has a framed photo. It's probably him in his dress uniform or
well,
whatever.
Well, in the interview, they pointed out that boys send nude photos too. But they're, you know, we shouldn't fall victim to any false equivalents here because it's not the first of all, the girls aren't trading them like trading
yeah.
cards. And also, to the girl, when the boy sends a nude photo, it's a symbol of the relationship reaching a certain level.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's not like, let's do this right now. We haven't even yeah. been dating for 2 minutes, but I need a nude photo,
yeah.
you know. So it's not the same at all.
And I will say, and this is because I'm willing to go here when you won't on the podcast, and I'll try and keep details minimal, but as we know, I'm kind of a big freaky pervert, and as I believe we've covered in here, I have seen my share of porn like today, let alone every other day. This is the thing I run into, my being a hardcore feminist and a pretty hardcore pervert. I find myself frequently in a situation where I have to come to terms with the fact that something arouses me that I also find offensive.
Yeah,
and it's
would be
it's
a difficult
constantly
situation.
There, almost everything, to the degree that I sort of have to turn it up, and to the degree that I keep, despite the fact that I will talk about things pretty frankly, certain, I don't even know what the kinks might be, go to fetishes or whatever, certain preferences or whatever that I have, in general, I will keep them quiet because I don't want to influence society with them because I know they were acculturated in with me growing up and it's mm-hmm. part of how I was raised and who I am.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I'm not going to deny them myself. I'm not going to be like, oh no, I have to, I'm that's a bad, I can't, I mean, I don't do anything illegal and I certainly don't exploit anyone that I know or anything like that.
Right.
But it's that weird parallel, and I'll find people who get very confused about this because if we get into a conversation, I'll be like, yeah, that stuff is terrible, and they're like, but and I need to say, just so you know, none of the details I'm leaving out are issues of legality or anything, and nothing that is illegal or anything like that. It's just in the same way, after taking gender studies classes, I could never watch MTV again without being like, oh my God.
Yeah, yeah.
To a certain degree, being educated at the point I am and having the feminist beliefs I have, I can never masturbate the same way again.
Okay.
It's terrible to see the very sort of damaging culture we're talking about,
mm-hmm.
how intimately I see that in my own self.
Oh, well, sure.
And how I can work against it, but it'll never be eradicated. Yeah, but
you, of course, you don't have to be someone who enjoys pornography to feel that way. I face that all the time myself.
Yes, but enjoying pornography is just a parade of illustrations of how this is an effect.
You're right.
It's a constant reminder, right. And it's very disconcerting. And when people talk about it, because I'm also a big advocate of, I don't believe in thought crime. I believe that what people are into sexually as a fantasy is fine as long as it's a fantasy and as long as everybody involved is aware and consensual and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Including stuff that just, you know, terrible. Well, and prime examples is, you know, I've known many women who had rape fantasies,
mm-hmm.
who absolutely don't want to get raped.
No. That's.
But have had rape fantasies.
I'm kind of surprised that people don't understand that concept.
Simply
because of the word fantasy.
People have complications with that word.
I know, but the word fantasy pretty much explains what's going on here.
But when you're talking about yourself and you're like, I have a fantasy in XYZ, and again, as a feminist, I know that would be a transgressive behavior in the world that I would hate, and I know where it stems from.
Sure.
It's really hard to sort of come face to face with that, and especially if you're talking about computer pornography, you literally come face to face with
that's,
it like,
that's
all
true.
The time.
Although, I would point this out that, first of all, when it comes to seeing the way the sexist culture has influenced you, it's important for one not to sort of, you know, beat themselves up about it, because that's not going to help.
Yeah.
And it's not really your fault that happened. I mean, that was the culture really did that to you.
But it's okay.
So you really need to process it like that. And another thing is that for a lot of people, and this might be the explanation of some rape fantasies that women have. For some people, to fantasize about certain things is actually a way of sort of therapeutically dealing with those specific things. So that's not a bad thing. It's how you are processing that through or coping with that, because it's there. There's no point in pretending it's not there. There's no point in beating yourself up about it. Everyone's going to have these problems because that's where our culture is and our society is. And the best thing for you to do is to be frank about it and cope with it the best way you can. And for some people, that coping strategy does involve certain types of fantasizing and sometimes sexual fantasizing, and that's therapeutic.
There was a lovely story in an interview that comedian Jackie Cation did one time, and she was very careful to leave out details. But she apparently, in her younger days, had some sort of sexual trauma that, as near as I can tell, may have involved like molestation on, I think, a bus.
Mm.
And it was something in particular, and she's always had conflicting feelings about it because it was terrible, but it also, on sort of a primal level, was arousing. And apparently it led to something with her, I think at the time already husband. Her husband now, but maybe boyfriend at the time.
Okay.
And something they were doing that was somehow reminiscent and therefore freaked her out.
Sure.
And so things stopped. And so they talked about it. And because of the type of person he was, he basically came up with a plan wherein they role-played that scenario, but this time instead of... his whole point was, you end it with me, and you like me, as opposed to this terrible stranger that took advantage of you or whatever.
Well, also...
And apparently it did wonders.
Yeah, but exactly. Also, in that role-playing situation... she can imagine herself as having a little more control over the situation than she actually did.
Yes.
And so there's a kind of a, it reforms the emotions around the memory. I mean, yeah, very therapeutic.
It becomes, yeah.
Very therapeutic.
But a good example of what I'm talking about before I put this out there, because I figured this one is pretty okay. So, not long ago, we had this issue of a bunch of celebrity nude photos leaked.
Yeah.
Bunch of them.
Yeah.
Tons of them. I was horrified, with all right-thinking people, and aghast, and just really disturbed, and not terribly surprised, sadly, but aware of this. And, of course, didn't go looking for them or anything, because that's terrible. I'll be honest, I wanted to. I really did. At the same time as I'm so mad that somebody would do this and that somehow they consider the celebrity okay, and this is the fact that, of course, it's all women and things like this, still kind of totally wanted to see Jennifer Lawrence topless. And it just... it bugs me because then I suddenly feel like part of the problem. And I know that by making the conscious choice to not and to decry that behavior, that I am not part of the problem. I am exactly the opposite. But knowing that I want to, well, and that the idea like gets again, me going and stuff, it can be very hard to deal with.
Yeah, well, again, that's what I say. I mean, these are issues that we all have to deal with in one form or another, and there's no point saying they're not there. You just have to do the best you can. And so it's not an a lot of people want to think there are feminists and then there are pigs.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, nothing in between. Well, that's just not true.
I am a living example. I'm a feminist pig.
Well, all of us are. I mean, all men are impacted by this. All women are impacted by this. If you're a person who decides you're going to be a feminist, whatever gospel you're preaching as much to yourself as you are to anyone else. And sometimes you don't live up to it either. That's the whole point. If we can push these ideas to get out there so that young people can learn them and so that we can help sort of raise our own awareness, then maybe, you know, a lot of the terrible things that men and women have to go through because of this messed up culture we have will stop.
And it translates to other form of prejudice, classism, racism.
Yep, that's right.
We're all racist. And you need to be aware of that and you need to work against it.
Yeah, that's right.
But you aren't going to not be. It's too ingrained.
That's
like,
right.
It's happened. And if you have a good enough relationship and are introspective enough, Trish and I frequently, we're alone at home or we're alone in the car or something. If one of us does something that we ourselves catch as one of us will be talking about something and one of us will say, I just realized I made this racist assumption because of this. Mm. And we can say that to the other person and they're like, yeah. Or they can say, I'm not sure, it might be this. Or
yeah.
But it's a thing. Normally, you can sort of only do that in your head. But if you have a relationship and you're in private,
because
we talk about stuff that I'm like, we shouldn't talk about with other people.
Right.
But that's because we're being vulnerable and we're being honest and saying, honestly, when I'm in this situation, I feel this way, and I know it's sexist, and I know it's racist, and I know it's whatever.
Yeah.
But I want to be able to tell somebody, and I can you, my wife, that I do feel that way.
Yeah.
And acknowledge it as a real thing inside of me that I know is destructive and unhealthy.
Yeah, yeah.
And to a certain degree, I can do this here with you listeners when I talk about the sex stuff that I just talked about that. I might be fired the day after Thanksgiving because my boss is going to listen to
but
this.
But the
so
thing is,
be
being a lot of people who insist that they're not sexist or racist or anything else.
Anytime somebody says that, that's my immediate cue.
They're almost always in denial about it,
the
really.
Classic,
I mean, like,
the
they
classic
really do
one
know
is,
that they've got issues and they just don't want to
The classic it. One is, I'm not racist, but is the classic one. You always say that right before you say the most racist thing ever.
Yeah.
But just in general, anytime somebody says, I'm not racist, I'm like, you've got problems. Because to say that statement basically proves that you have not become aware or are unwilling to deal with the fact that you are. I would never say I'm not racist. And by a lot of people's definition, I'm not racist.
Yeah.
Because they don't think they're racist.
No, a lot of people wouldn't think I'm racist because they've never heard me say anything racist. But that doesn't
Because you're self-aware enough to say, if I have this thought, that's racist.
Yeah.
And that's my problem, not yours.
And then I don't say it.
Somebody recently...
Or do it.
I was just talking with somebody recently about the whole gay marriage thing, and we were so happy about how that was going and all this stuff. And they said to me, I've had to get to this point there was a time when it wigged me out. I understood it was me.
Mm.
I understood it was not them.
Mm.
But it used to make me uncomfortable. And I get that. I still have that with things. I mean, in general, because that's the thing. Yes, I'm racist. In general, I don't feel like I am. But I have my moments. But the one that gets me, the elderly, and more specifically, basically the disabled, make me very uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And always have.
Mm-hmm.
And it's 100% me. Like, I absolutely know that.
Sure,
it's
sure.
All me. And my mom, I don't know if she sensed it, or if maybe she was just trying to be good and actually may partially be responsible for why it's like this. Because she would work in nursing homes, and she would have me come and hang around there because she wanted me to be comfortable with it.
Mm.
And I wasn't, and I am not. But I know it's me, and I work hard not to.
Mm.
I don't shy away from interacting with anybody in that situation. And I attempt to treat them
the way you treat anybody else.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it becomes complicated because you want to treat them like anybody else, but also you don't ignore the situation.
No, that's right.
You
know, that's right.
I mean, it's but that's the thing.
But that's also what you would do for somebody else.
I work really hard to not make it their problem.
Yeah, right.
I work really hard for them to not have to suffer in any way for my reflective prejudices that I have yet to get over.
I
may never get over.
I get you.
And it's the same thing. We've got our reflexive prejudices against sex, against race, against class, against nationality to a degree.
Yep, yep.
I don't think it's escapable at this point.
Well, I mean, even if you find yourself, you know, you're watching a newscast and, you know, 300 people in, Yemen are killed in a bomb, and then you hear that there was a mass shooting in Miami, and
six people died, and
20 people died, and you're like heartbroken.
Yep.
What's that about?
Well,
when you think about
all of that, then the guy who's your neighbor, not even your friend, but you knew him because he was lived across the street or whatever, dies in a car wreck. That's even a bigger tragedy you.
So now, some of that's understandable. I mean, you are naturally going to feel a little bit worse for someone you know.
Absolutely.
But you don't know the people in Florida any better than you know the people in Yemen.
No.
So there's, when you really think about it, there's no rational reason for you to be more upset about one than the other, except that we've been indoctrinated in our country to think that loss of American lives is more. That's what you hear on the news.
Yep.
And then when there's a plane crash, this many Americans die. Well, what about the rest of them? They're not important.
Yep.
But you hear that over and over again, and pretty soon, without you even being able to help it, you just pay attention. When it's American lives, you feel worse.
And it's built around that, because here's the thing. If there is a criminal act that occurs and results in deaths, odds are the government, it depends on the scale, because we like to get in and help other countries, he said, using air quotes.
Yeah.
But the big thing is that if somebody who died was American, you damn well know our government gets involved then. And don't necessarily
just
otherwise.
Like the whole ISIS
and
thing.
part of you says, well, of course, the government's going to get involved for its citizens. And there's an argument to be made for that. There's
a whole thing there.
But the point is, I know that, and that's built into me.
Mm-hmm.
And so in my mind, it becomes a thing when an American dies. So in my mind, American deaths are equal to 1.84 of others.
Right.
You know, like.
Yeah, the
and some of it, and I mean, I don't know that there's a world where you're going to eliminate prejudice. We could probably make a major cultural shift, and all these prejudices would go away, and we'd have different prejudices.
No, sure, that's
it's
true.
It's like
that's
there's true. No way to not screw up your kid raising them, same kind of thing. But the point is, don't deny them, be aware of them, and then try and work to counter them as best as you can.
One of the things I used to say in a class that I taught back where you and I used to work, because we talked about thinking outside the box, you know, that was kind of a thing. And what I explained to people was, cognitively, we have frames. This is how we organize our world and we use. And you can't get away from them. And they're not bad. What's bad is if you put a frame on something and you don't let that frame change when it ought to.
You try and claim that the frame doesn't exist.
Yeah, you try to, or you just put the wrong frame on there and you just are stubborn about moving it. But like you say, in that case, you usually claim it doesn't exist.
Yeah, it's awareness of the frame.
Yeah.
Because
frames are how we think, but you don't have to pretend they don't exist, and you don't have to put them where they don't belong, and you don't have to let them stay someplace where the situations has changed and that frame doesn't apply anymore.
Creating any sort of psychological boundary in your head is a very useful organizational and emotional tool.
We can't help
it. You have to be aware that it exists, and you have to be aware that it is not set in stone, and you have to constantly verify whether or not it should be where it is.
Yep, exactly. Exactly.
And
right.
We've got less time than before, so let's do something here.
Sorry, everybody.
I feel like this is a really good talk.
Yeah, I hope that was still an interesting conversation, everybody. And this is from Sue the Malcontent.
Oh, I hear she's an anarchist.
I don't think so.
No, she actually believes in a theocracy headed entirely by Peter Gabriel.
Dear Hat Masters. Ooh, I like the sound of that.
I feel like that's weird.
Okay. Well, it just seems more empowering than what we usually get.
It sounds like a an odd 3 a.m. shopping channel show. Welcome to Hat Masters. We got some great hats for you today.
What are your favorite pieces of classical music? That's a good question. I wish I could answer it, because here's the thing about me and classical music. There are a lot of pieces I like, but I never know what they're called, or I never remember what they're called.
You like anything that was in Looney Tunes. Appalachian Spring, Barbara Seville, all of that.
William Tell Overture.
I don't do so good with pieces. I do better with composers, and that took me many years to get there.
Yeah, a lot of times I don't even know who the composer is.
Well, and I run into the issue. I'm going to say classical. Keep in mind, I may be referring to the Baroque, Romantic, or classical periods. Fuck you. We're just going to call them classical.
Well, or...
because that's what everybody calls them.
Well, but some people call
them modern classical.
Yeah,
yes,
modern classical is just classical,
so
too. It's like a genre.
It could be Bach, Philip Glass, anything in between.
Okay.
Don't
I think that's
split
fair.
Any goddamn
I,
hairs
I,
with
I think,
me.
I think Sue
that
would
being
probably
said,
agree to
I
that.
Would probably say my favorite classical composer, full stop, is Chopin.
Really?
It has taken me many years to discover. I really like Frédéric Chopin a lot. When I was studying instruments and had more exposure to this stuff, there were a few more modern classical composers, like Kavalevsky was a 20th century composer that I was a big fan of at the time. And, you know, I mean, I like all the classics fine. I'm a big fan of Mozart. That feels like a weird thing to say, like I support the troops or something. I mean, but I do. Mozart's good. I like Mozart. Good stuff. The Baroque stuff a little less. I mean, I can appreciate good Bach. I have Bach on my iPod. I wouldn't say he's a go-to for me.
Okay.
Chopin's a big one for me. Liszt is good. Handel's good. Beethoven, fine, whatever. Schumann, you know. I mean, but I don't know if there's like pieces that I would say really.
It's kind of interesting. A lot of people do have favorite pieces of classical music because they'll listen to it while they run or work out or while they're doing something to motivate them. They'll listen to a particular classical piece.
Yeah.
But I, you know,
on TV shows, it happens a lot.
I mean, unfortunately, you're pretty much right. I mean, I like the stuff I heard on Looney Tunes cartoons, and I like John Williams soundtracks.
There you go.
You know, that's. I'm sorry. I'm a.
There
Philistine,
is a particular
I know, but...
that I want to say is a Philip Glass. I don't know.
I do like Philip Glass. Actually,
there is a very specific. Melody. There's a very specific refrain that gets used constantly in things that is basically a situation of abject horror and tragedy. It frequently gets used in situations where you're seeing a fight in the war where people are shooting each other and it's kind of in slow motion. And it's this weird piece with a violin that sort of rises.
And it's still
up.
Class?
I don't know. That's the thing. Oh. It has a name. I've seen it before and the piece has a name. It might be Copeland. It might be Glass. I don't know. But this is the thing. I really like that piece. And I don't know. And here's the most specific...
It's not operatic, is it?
No. Okay. It's wholly... It's really just a violin. I mean, there's other accompaniment, but it's essentially a violin.
Hmm.
And here is the one specific example I know off the top of my head that I can give you where it was used. So you lunatics can go on the internet and find this. It was an episode of Seinfeld in which, for reasons I do not remember, Kramer had to convince George's father, played by Jerry Stiller, to cook food for some sort of mixer. I don't remember what it was. It was some social gathering. He was going to cook the food because in the war, Costanza, I don't remember his first name on the show, but it, Jerry Stiller's character. No, George was the main guy. Jerry Stiller is something Costanza. Anyway, Jerry Stiller's character was a cook in the army, and he had a tragedy where they found some steak and it had gone bad, and so he was too brash and he seasoned it, saying it would be fine, and he seasoned it too much and he made everybody sick. And something happens in he cooks again in this thing, and something happens where something was bad or something tastes weird, and people start like coughing or whatever, and he starts essentially having a flashback and freaking out. And in that scene, it's in slow motion and they're playing this music.
Okay.
So you can find it there. It might be Copeland. It might not be Glass.
I can never remember the guy's name who composed this, and it's an operatic piece, but I do like it, even though it has been played to death in a lot of different things. But it's O Fortuna. Do you know that one?
Yes.
I like that. I realize
it's from... It's not... It's... This is a thing. People think it's from Carmen. It's not from Carmen.
Oh, okay.
It's one of those that...
But it's that composer, though, isn't it?
Yeah. I think it really hit prominence in the modern culture because they used it a bunch for the Bram Stoker's Dracula movie.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, they used it in a lot of trailers and stuff. I don't know if they actually used it in the movie. They used it in all the trailers.
But it's actually, it's not only is it a good piece to listen to, but if you've ever like read the translation of the lyrics, it's really fascinating. Latin lyrics. Yeah. It's really, I really like it.
It is a good one. I can't deny that one.
But I always forget the name of the guy who composed it.
Yeah.
He was obviously in a really bad mood that day because, I mean, the lyrics are all about how cruel fate is and how, you know, leads you to think everything's great and then takes everything away.
A lot of those old ones, when I used to sing...
Very sad.
I had some classical training and I sang a lot of Italian.
Oh.
And the lyrics to those are always either the most sloppy, ridiculous love song ever, or they're the most slip my wrists and get in the bathtub, well, depressing things.
I think it's
ever.
Latin. I mean, do you
it
know?
Could be Italian. I don't know for sure.
Maybe it's Italian. If
opera
I,
at the time was largely going to be Italian.
Okay, well, if I was wrong about being Latin, I apologize. It might have been Italian.
It's pretty close. We're over time, so we should wrap it up. I hope you all have had a lovely Thanksgiving. Yeah. I hope we have had a lovely Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I hope we have too.
Probably
have.
Next week, things might be normal. I don't know. Pretty soon, we're going to have to record like three at once
or
something. Yeah. And we're going to try doing them simultaneously just for different. Instead of. They're going to be concurrent instead of consecutive. So enjoy that. In the meantime, go make a leftover turkey sandwich.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.